Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about security on home networks on the show today. We'll learn about VPNs, DNS protection, and different internet browsers to use with our regular guest. Jesse LeGrew back with us. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Always great to have him come by. Have questions about setting up your home network to be more secure? Have you ever used a search engine like DuckDuckGo? We'll take your technology-related questions and love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Jesse LeGrew, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Our iPhone users may have recently gotten a new update on their phones having to do with privacy. They're rolling out something called App Tracking Transparency, or ATT. Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah, so in many cases, we use a variety of applications. You know, even if it's not on a mobile device, we'll use a website, and a variety of the things that we do might be tracked, or they might be the data might be shared or even sold to other parties. And this transparency aspect for the iOS update is to at least notify users, hey, by the way, are you okay with sharing this data? Would you like to continue sharing this information? And at least gives the end user a little bit more of an indication that data is actually being shared. Because in many other cases, they're kind of tied up in the things that we generally don't see every day, which is the privacy policy of an organization. It can be extremely lengthy, or it might be included in an end user license agreement. So rather than people needing to go and read that information, it gives you a prompt when that might take place, so you can actually say yes or no and get that information up front.
So as a phone owner, what do you need to do to make a smart decision here?
Well, just like anything, definitely recommend that anyone update their device. If you don't have the latest iOS update and you're an iPad or iPhone user, I highly recommend updating to the most recent version of iOS, which will have that feature enabled, so you will get prompted. And then from there, you know, it's kind of a personal decision on what you would or would not want to share. There has been a lot of conversation back and forth in terms of what is the benefit of sharing this data, but also what are the privacy concerns. And one of the potential benefits of sharing this data is getting a more customized experience, because you know, the company you're sharing your data with, or the companies they're sharing that data with, allow to give you a more customized experience based upon, you know, decisions that you make, websites that you browse, or other items that they're able to collect. So, you know, I always recommend people, if you share that data, make sure it's with an organization that you're comfortable sharing that information with. They might also be sharing it with other third parties. But if you do want to make sure that your information is private, getting that pop-up so you can deny sharing of that information, it's empowering in that it lets you make that decision instead of it potentially being made for you if you haven't read all of the legalese that it's really challenging to go through.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure 99.9% of us haven't read that whole thing. At least I haven't. This is for iPhone. Do you anticipate we'll see more changes or more things like this for Android users?
I think we'll see this a lot more frequently as time moves on. There have been a lot of moves with privacy and empowering end users to have more control of the data that describes them and kind of the life around them. A lot of this came with GDPR and a variety of other data privacy regulations, both internationally and nationally. And this just seems to be a trend moving forward. And I think we saw it a lot as well with COVID and the adoption of new technologies. As we use more resources, especially cloud-based resources, our data just tends to spread out to the internet. And how to maintain control of that data is extremely challenging because it's hard to know where that information is. So I think we're going to see probably more regulation in this space. And with that, I think we're also going to see organizations needing to either comply with those regulations or at least helping to be a little bit more transparent and giving a little bit more control to the end user so they can make a more informed decision. Because I think everyone has known for a very long time that most people do not read end user license agreements and they do not read privacy policies. So it's hard for individuals to really understand what they're doing, even though that consent is implied. So I think companies will be trying to double check with users, hey, by the way, you know, this is happening. We want to make sure you're okay with it. And giving the end users that information. So I do think we're going to see a lot more of it. This is just another step in that direction of helping to empower, you know, people that use technology every day.
You know, there's a few browsers that I think most people use. Google Chrome, you got Microsoft Edge, you got Safari. But there's some newer things emerging called, one new thing called a private browser. DuckDuckGo is one of them. What are the differences there?
Yeah, and there's a variety of differences between kind of what the browsers are doing and what information they may collect or share with other third parties. DuckDuckGo is a browser that's been out there for a while, and a lot of people were are users of it, especially due to privacy. And this is mainly because a lot of the items, when we visit websites, a lot of things are stored on our computers that help to track our activity. Some of this can be, for good things where I want to visit a website and the next time I go to it, maybe I don't want to type in my username and password. So it helps to store I logged in with a certain period of time and I don't have to do it again. Well, in many cases, that uses cookies or it might use other technologies. DuckDuckGo, in many cases, will not store cookies to reduce that data being stored on your computer because other websites may be able to pick up on that data or use it in other ways. Or there could also be, you know, malicious bad actors out there that try to get that information. So, you know, usually the less data you store, the less risk there is to that data, including compromising those services that you use all the time. You wouldn't want somebody to be able to get into your social media just because they were able to get information about a cookie on your device. One way to help get around that is just not to store that cookie. And so that's one example where DuckDuckGo or other browsers might help to improve that privacy and that security by actually using some really old technology to try to give us a better user experience. So there's kind of a trade-off. A lot of sites that require cookies, maybe they won't work in a certain browser, but that's part of the challenge and the balance in going to different websites, because there are also websites out there that can be a little bit more dangerous, it's a little bit more of a challenge.
Yeah, and DuckDuckGo, that's something you would have to install that on your computer in order to get it to work, I would assume.
Correct. And it's a free web browser. It is available for mobile devices as well. Most devices will come built in with their own web browser. It might be Edge for a Windows device. It might be Google Chrome if you have a Google or Android device. Or it might be Safari if you're using a Mac OS device. But there are a variety of third-party browsers that you can use. But a lot of the built-in browsers with some of the your native device software will actually have a variety of things that you can do there as well. It's just turning on or off certain features. So you can actually, you know, for example, remove cookies when you close a session or only use them for certain periods of time. Saving passwords can also be challenging as well, depending on how it's stored. But a lot of your browsers can actually be changed to be more security focused and be a little bit more private. DuckDuckGo is just a really good example where a lot of that's just there by default. So most of us don't have to or don't want to think about what to change just to make my browser to work. So whenever you can get something where you can download it, install it, and it's configured at least for that optimal experience, you can use that. If you ever have an issue, you can always move back to a different browser, which tends to be, I think I'm used to doing that just for a variety of troubleshooting. But if you have an issue with, let's say, DuckDuckGo, and you're like, well, I don't know if it's a privacy setting that's causing an issue, you could always use a different browser to test, as long as you're, you know, pretty confident that the website you're going to is safe. But having something that does track less data, does share less of that information with third parties, or collect it themselves is beneficial. And they do have that directly within their actual privacy policy. Since we use a web browser every day, I think if there is one privacy policy to read, it might be the one that is the web browser that you're using, because most of the data we flow through the internet on a day-to-day basis is going through that web browser. It is through a banking website. It is through social media. And they do have it spelled out there. It's they're challenging to read because they're technically focused, but there's a lot of people out there that summarize the information very well so people can understand what they're doing. But basically, the less data you collect, the better. It helps to improve your privacy, even though you might not get the most customized experience possible.
Jesse LeGrew, our guest, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Great to have him with us. Questions for him as we move along. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Talking about home network security today on the show. Jesse, when you use the term home network, what all does that refer to?
Usually a home network, I think in the easiest way to describe it is, especially for anyone using broadband services such as DSL or cable modem, you know, you have a line that comes from your internet provider, and you might have a cable or a DSL modem plugged in. That actually might have everything you need to do your day-to-day internet usage. It might come with a built-in router. It might come in with Wi-Fi. But it's really that environment that allows you to connect to the internet through your internet service provider. And everyone has a little bit different setup and a little bit different complexity, but it really is kind of starts with that modem that allows you to get access to the internet, and whatever devices you have connecting to that internet as well, you know, is basically your home network. And traditionally, I think, well, not traditionally, but I think currently for a lot of people, that's Wi-Fi or wireless access, not just for our laptops and our desktops and our phones, but also for what they call Internet of Things devices, such as home automation. It could be lights, could be your garage door opener, it could be your doorbell. A lot of those are increasing too. So we're seeing a great expansion of the home network, not just being, I have my laptop connecting to Facebook, but I have 20 different devices on my home network that's keeping track of which lights are turning on and what color at a certain period of time, to making sure I get a reminder if my garage door is still open.
And there, I could see where there can be some security issues or vulnerability issues from hackers or viruses when you start adding up that many different places in your home network.
Yeah, there's a lot of dangerous things to take a look at out there, and I think you know, part of it is the devices that we're using at home. But I think traditionally it's also just kind of what we do on a day-to-day basis with our computers. And you can go to one bad website and have everything just turned upside down, where you might be infected with a virus or, you know, as we've seen recently in the news, you could have ransomware or something else in your device, and you could lose data. And I think that's still one of the riskier parts, especially with a lot of people simply, you know, doing more interactions at home or at other locations where you're accessing the internet, and it can just be going to a place that you shouldn't or clicking on a link in an email that opens you up to a lot of potentially dangerous things. And I think there's a lot of there's still a lot of challenges with doing that because it's still really easy to go to a bad internet location and be susceptible to the bad software and malicious websites that are out there.
Yeah. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Natalie Guyette, our producer today. Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your home network and zeroing in a little bit on security, we can take some other questions as well relating to all of your devices with our guest, Jesse LeGrew, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Mike in Madison, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hey, Jesse. I've got a Netgear router, and I've been attempting to change the password in it. I can get through all the steps up and to the point where I should be able to press a continue button after putting in all the passwords and notifications, and that button is grayed out on the website. So I'm kind of running into a dead end on how to change a password.
Sounds like there's something missing yet. If it's still gray, Mike, I don't know. What do you think, Jesse?
There'd be a couple things that I would take a look at right away to see if it resolves the issue. One would be to potentially reset the router just to factory defaults in case there's anything else that would be clouding things up that would not allow you to make the change. Another one would be to update the firmware or the software on the router because maybe there's a fix that was released that would make that work better. Those are two initial things that I would try. Granted, resetting the router, depending on how complicated your network setup is at home, might create a different issue, but it could be a way to resolve the issue. I'm trying to think. One other piece of information I did find, sometimes there are security questions for a variety of devices. They might require those security questions to be answered. If those security questions were not answered, that actually could be a reason why the button was grayed out or there's another issue. So I have seen a few other comments from Netgear in regards to this, but it's a little bit tricky in terms of how that grayed out button might be applied. But I would try just updating the latest firmware if you do have it. If you do have an older router and you don't have the option to upgrade and it's been several years, I would actually consider even replacing the router. Just due to the fact home routers are attacked from the internet regularly these days, and actually having an out-of-date router could be a little bit dangerous as well if it's out there. And usually a router you can actually get fairly inexpensively. But first I would try update the router to reset it and try to set it up from scratch, if possible, which will hopefully allow you to reset the password. Otherwise, just make sure you've addressed any security questions that are out there and set all of the fields that are possible in that password reset page.
There you go, Mike. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Madison, west side of Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two things I need to ask you about. One is that it seems that all of the phone numbers in all of my contacts are no longer separated with parentheses and hyphens, and that's really different. I don't know how that happened. And then the other thing that I think I did by touching the wrong thing is that when I send a picture to somebody or myself, it's from my iCloud email, but I don't want it to be that. I want it to come from my Gmail account. And it used to, but then it changed, and now I don't know what to do about it.
Okay. All right, Jesse, two things there.
Okay. So it sounds like you're very likely using an iPhone. And my initial thought on the contacts, I'm not sure if this was a change with the latest iOS update. They might have a format feature in the contacts to change how it's displayed. I would actually just recommend going into the settings and contacts to see if there is an option for changing that setting. It's likely actually going to be very similar to the location if you're looking to change settings for how your messaging and sharing functions for pictures. So if you are using an iPhone or an iPad, there's a variety of sharing options that are available. And in many cases, they'll also use iMessage, which can sometimes be challenging with a variety of different devices. If you do want to make sure you're sharing it with email, I would recommend going into your settings on your device and looking at the sharing settings for, in this case specifically, iCloud. If you do, especially if you do have people where you are sharing information and they are not iPhone users, or I should just say iOS users, you might want to change the messaging that you're using. And so if you do go to settings, you'll see something for messages, and then you will have a variety of options there to turn on or turn off iMessage, what account that you're using, and also a few of the different options for how it's showing, you know, your contacts, and a few other items. So I would take a look at that messages items. Generally, I recommend if you do have people that just don't all have iPhones, I would normally turn iMessage off, and then you can send or receive with a different method. Usually it would use SMS. If you do turn iMessage on and you have other devices, it does allow you to share information between those devices. But it could allow you to change potentially the email address that you're sending to or sending from. So I would check your messages settings. The contacts, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I would go to your settings in the contacts menu just to see if there is an option for how it does display that phone number. My guess is it might just be a recent setting change that you have that might have been due to an iOS update. You may or may not be able to change it, but it would be one of the first places I would go to at least take a look.
Yep, for sure. Jan, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Ron in Crystal Lake, Illinois, will turn to you now. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Jesse. Great show. Appreciate the info. You know, I've had a drastic influx of odd emails lately where it seems my information has been shared, and these emails have, you know, misspellings, and they seem to be representing companies, and they just don't look right to me. In years past, I typically click the unsubscribe link and go on our merry way, but I'm really reluctant to hit this unsubscribe link on these suspect emails. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, probably a good idea not to do it, Jesse. I don't, at least from my perspective.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yes, it's a tricky one. So in some cases, the unsubscribe might be valid. In some cases, they could be a little bit dangerous. One thing I'd recommend doing is most of the built-in mail features, whether you're using Gmail or if you're using Hotmail or any of the other Microsoft 365 services or, you know, anything else, they usually do have a report spam or report phishing button. If you do think it's just generally spam and it's not malicious, I would recommend reporting it as spam. If you do actually think it's a malicious email that's, you know, might have a virus or, you know, you might be scared about whatever it's asking, you can also report it as phishing. But that will at least prompt, you know, the organization that's hosting your email to usually do analysis in the background. And so that's good information for them. So the more people that report something, the more they have the ability to look into it and see if there's an opportunity to either filter that email or update some of the other filters they have on their side, which, you know, usually there are a variety of spam filters and everything else built in. Usually, once you do report that, it usually will remove it from your inbox. If it doesn't, you can usually still mark it as junk. It'll remove it, and over time, your email client will kind of learn what you've marked as junk, and you'll hopefully start seeing less and less of it in your inbox. So, you know, I'd report it, and then I'd mark it as junk if it doesn't, you know, automatically remove it, and then just continue to do that, and eventually that information will be filtered out. Another thing I'd recommend is, one, Google your email address. You might find out that your email address is simply easy to find out on the internet, and there are ways to unsubscribe. It can be really time-consuming, but you can do it. But at least gives you an idea how your data might have gotten out there. Another resource I would recommend is going to a website called haveibeenpwned.com, and that's haveibeenpwned.com. You can actually use that website, type in your email address. It will actually give you information, at least whether there's been a reported breach that's included your email address at any point. So that could be another mechanism your email has gotten out there for other people to use, is because, you know, you're using your email address in a third party. They have that email address now, and it's being used for a variety of spamming mechanisms. So those are my recommendations. It also could be somebody simply got your email address because someone you know or someone they know got compromised somehow and their address book is out there. So it's hard to know exactly how they get the information. You can do a little bit of investigation to find out. But the best thing you can do, at least to clean up your inbox, is report those emails, mark them as junk, and just keep an eye on it and be careful not to click on anything that you know, you might be concerned about. That could also be the unsubscribe button. So it depends on how valid that email looks, but also whether it is actually from a reputable company. So if you're not confident it's safe to click on, I would report it and then move on. If you do need to take some action, if it tells you to do something, like let's say it's your bank and they tell you to do something, just call your bank at their publicly listed number. Don't use the one that's in the email. So hopefully it's just junk you can mark and move on. If it is something deeper, contact whatever organization with their publicly posted number and don't use the information in the email. It'll help at least to keep you safe, and you won't have to worry about clicking on something that you know, you might regret later.
Yeah. Good luck, Ron. Thank you. Russ in Stoughton, your turn now. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm in Wisconsin. My cell phone has a 608 area code, and I get all sorts of incoming calls with a 608 area code. And normally I don't answer them, but if you do answer them and say hello, there is nobody on the line, you get nothing. And then if you call that number back, you get the recording that says you've dialed incorrectly or you've contacted a non-working number. What is with those calls?
Yeah, it's a really good question. There's a lot of that going on at the moment. It's actually been, you know, robocalls and getting spam phone calls have been out there for a while, but it's definitely been far more aggressive recently. And in many cases, you know, they're looking for somebody to pick up and to state something, really to validate whether the number is real or not. So it could really just be somebody trying to validate, is there somebody at the other end of this phone line that I can mark, you know, we will get an answer. We can use this phone number for a campaign at some other point in the future. So it's very likely that it could have just been a little bit of reconnaissance by some organization or some individual just trying to validate, is there somebody at the other end of this line, or should I remove it from my call list because, you know, it's not there, it's disconnected. So it's very likely that's what's kind of going on at that point. Now, in terms of calling back and it not being functional, a lot of those robocalls are using spoofed phone numbers. So they are falsifying the phone number that you're seeing on your end. So it's very likely it's not a real number. And they get they're really good at, you know, providing phone numbers that you're used to seeing with your same area code, or even with the same, you know, the first three digits of your phone number after the area code. They tend to make those match just so you feel like it's someone you are more likely to know, and so you're more likely to pick up. But usually they're just fake phone numbers. Sometimes they go back to a real phone number, sometimes they don't. But more often than not, those phone numbers are being completely falsified, and it's actually not the true source of who's calling you. Another thing you can do is you can actually get them blocked. You can report it to your phone company. And I know, at least for mine, if I go online onto my website, they do actually have phone numbers where I can block or report different calls. And there are some other things carriers might be able to do, but there are some challenges currently with just how our phone system's built that makes it a lot more problematic. So I'm hoping over the next several years there's going to be improvements to that. But just like a lot of emails, one of the best things you can do is actually report it, because the phone companies do have some capability to at least look behind the scenes and see really where a phone number is actually being routed. And so they can use that and do some things on their end that otherwise, as an end user, you really can't do. So if you can't report it, at least there's a higher chance that something could be done. So if not you not getting that next phone call, maybe somebody else won't get it.
Yeah, good points. Russ, thanks. Bob in La Crescent, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have my own Wi-Fi device, and it came with a original password, and they recommend changing that when you get it. Now, I've never changed it, but I'm in a rural location where, you know, my range is, you know, maybe just around my house. And there's no house, maybe one house that could reach me. Is it necessary for me to change that password, or is that accessible by further distances than, you know, the Wi-Fi reach?
That's a good question. Do you, for your internet connection, do you have any? Do you currently have an internet connection that's always turned on? Or do you have to manually connect to it?
It's always on.
Okay. Since you do have an internet connection that's always on, I would highly recommend changing the password, because even though, you know, to get onto your wireless specifically, anyone needs to be kind of close to your area in order to jump onto your wireless and get onto your network, it is possible, since, you know, your wireless network is connected to the internet, that someone could, really anywhere in the world, in theory, get to your router, break into that, and find their way onto your home network using that method. So you kind of have that tether that's always open, and it's a potential risk. So I'd highly recommend changing the password, at least so no one on the internet can attack your router. It is something that's, you know, those attacks are happening all the time, every day, and I've seen them for a variety of consumer devices, and, you know, it's the names are out there, they're very common organizations or companies that make these devices, so I'd highly recommend changing it, and while you're taking a look at it, I would also recommend changing any other settings for. They'll usually have two settings. One is for remote administration. I'd usually recommend turning that off. And the other one is universal plug and play. I'd also recommend turning that off. So if you're already taking a look at the settings, take a look at those. Now, as I said all that, I also realized you might have been just talking about your wireless password. So, you know, the password you type in just to get onto your wireless. That password's likely safe if no one's in your area. Your router has a separate password for administration that allows you to change settings, including what wireless networks you have and how to connect to them. That was the password that I was referring to earlier. Your wireless password, if no one's physically near you, it's likely to be more safe. But I still would recommend, if it is default, at least changing it to something that only you know, just to make sure it's more protected. But in this case, you actually have a couple different passwords to potentially be concerned about. But if you do have any default passwords for really any device you own, I always recommend changing it. A lot of those passwords are, in most cases, those are well documented and they're publicly available on the internet, meaning that as long as somebody knows what kind of device you have, they might be able to break into it with really no effort because the password's available publicly. So if you do have a default password out there, I'd recommend changing it to one that only you know, so no one can take that easy action, just guess the password that comes with the device.
There you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Brown Deer, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, John.
Well, good morning, and thank you for accepting my call. Currently on my computer, I have installed and I'm running two sort of cleansing safeguard programs. One is CCleaner, and the other is Malwarebytes. Now, recently I received an email from WinZip, and I use WinZip, but I received this email offering me a great discount on a new a security system that is designed to cleanse the computer in a way that a professional would cleanse it and to examine it and clean it out and so forth. And my question is, with the other two software programs installed, would installing a third one sort of gum up the works and would these systems or programs interfere with each other?
That's a really good question. In a lot of cases, you really want to only have one active software running at any point, just because sometimes they can conflict with each other. For example, if you have two antivirus programs, you know, one might find a virus, the other one might find the same virus that the other one just quarantined, and they kind of had this tug of war where they both want to quarantine this file, and they're just never quite doing it. From the two programs you have, CCleaner and Malwarebytes, Malwarebytes can have active protection, which is generally pretty good. One thing I will note with any of the programs, all antivirus or anti-malware programs will see different things, and sometimes one program will see something that another program does not. So you'll never be 100% effective with any one program, so it can be nice to have options. It is possible this other application could be useful if it's not running active with another program at the same time. So if it's more of a passive scanning tool, I think it could be useful. But in many cases with a lot of the antivirus or anti-malware programs out there, you want at least one program running actively all the time. That's making sure that if you download a file, it's being scanned at the time, or it's noticing unusual activity with your computer or with your user account. So I'd also recommend, you know, depending on what the program is, make sure that the application that you might purchase is a valid one and that others have used and that there is a good community around. There's a lot of fake antivirus programs out there that they'll either sell you or you'll get for free, which will actually install malware. So I would just make sure and validate that the program you're looking at is a true antivirus or anti-malware program. And they can cause conflicts for any of these. You know, make sure you have one active one. Don't have two active ones at the same time. I would also recommend, you know, for most things, you know, keep your device up to date. Make sure that you go to websites that you know are trustworthy, and you know, be careful about clicking on links on your email. Keeping your software updated is a significant barrier to any kind of malware you might download. And I know CCleaner and Malwarebytes help, especially for some of the malware, but also for privacy by cleaning up cookies and other files. So make sure you keep your applications updated, and that'll be a significant fix. You may or may not need this additional program, but if you do decide to invest in it and it is valid, I would just recommend not having two active applications running at the same time because they might conflict with each other.
Yep. That makes good sense as well. Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He's our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your home network today with our guest, Jesse LeGrew from Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Call us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of email, Susan in Duluth emailed to say that DuckDuckGo has been her usual browser for a year or so. She rarely needs Google to find needed sites. Wondering if she installed DuckDuckGo already, since she has. Why does it keep suggesting she makes it her browser? Did she actually install it, or did she only make it her homepage?
Oh, that's a good question. It could be actually that she might be using the DuckDuckGo search, which is just DuckDuckGo.com, but they also have the additional browser or plugins you can use for different browsers as well. So it could be that actually she is using just the default search engine of DuckDuckGo.com. It could also be that maybe she is using that browser. It's just not set as default. So for Windows, Mac OS, and most operating systems, whenever you try to access a web page, it will use whatever it considers the default. It could be Edge, Firefox, Chrome, Safari. But it'll try to open one of those programs. It may not be set to DuckDuckGo as the option. And if you are using a Windows computer, in the control panel, they do have default programs. Default programs will basically tell the computer, where do I go? And similar in settings for iOS devices or preferences, it'll have defaults for which application to run. And there's similar applications for, Google devices or similar. So that would be a place to go see if it is a default program. But it could just be you are using, Chrome, Firefox, or a different browser with the DuckDuckGo search. If you do want to use the DuckDuckGo browser, you can actually go ahead and download and install it. Another way to just verify whether you have DuckDuckGo installed, if you do have Windows or Mac OS, you can hit the Windows or the Apple key and just type in DuckDuckGo. If you don't get any results, usually it's going to be searching for programs that are installed on your device. If you do not see DuckDuckGo, there's a high chance that it's not installed on your computer. So if you do want to install it, basically follow those instructions from DuckDuckGo.com and install it. And usually after installation, it'll give you an option. Would you like to make this your default, meaning that it will be the browser that you're using on a day-to-day basis? So that'll tell you at least if it's on there or not, or if you do want to install it. But it could be you are just using their search engine.
Yep, there you go. Jerry in Hudson, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I am still having issues with the sort of updated Google's photos or the actual app. And it appears that they've hijacked the photo feature at this point because they control everything, and I cannot get my photos out of Google Photos. I did buy or did get a SD card and installed it. Some things downloaded to it, not one photo downloaded. There's no way to send it to that. So if I finally figure out how to get at my photos to do something with them other than, send them to Google Photos for printing or making a book or anything else, I don't know what the best place to store them at this point is. I do have both old photos in iCloud. I've had iPhones in the past and iPad, but I've recently been using Android phones, so I have an assortment of them. But I like the Google Photos features, but now they've kind of locked it down. It's like, hey, you've got to buy everything through us, and when you send any emails to friends, they have to open up their Google Photos to actually see them, which is really irritating. So I'm trying to get them out, and then if I get them out, what would you recommend for storage?
Okay.
All right. So there are a couple things I would recommend, and I know there have been a few changes to the Google Photos options, and including the Photos application that they have, and I think they had similar stuff to their Music app as well. If you are looking to back up your photos, just to make sure that you do have an offline copy and that they're not, you know, maybe directly on your phone or on the Google Photos website, I'd probably recommend doing a couple things. One is I'd probably back up all your photos just from the Google Photos library, which is, you know, if you go to photos.google.com, I would go to, you know, a basic, you know, computer that you do have. And you can go to their website. You will see at least all of the photos that you currently have available there. And what you can do is you can actually download all the photos zipped up from that location so that you can store it offline. So, you know, if you did want to move it to a different service, you know, there's a lot of them out there. It could be, you know, you could use iCloud, you could use Dropbox, you could use a variety of different services. You could store it there as well, or just have a backup. And another recommendation I would have outside of backing it up directly from the website is to actually back it up from your phone in a few different ways. And there are backup applications you can get for your Google phone. Depending on the age of your phone, you can actually just plug it into a normal computer. And it will basically read your phone like it was a flash drive or an external hard drive. And you can drag and drop the folders from your device onto your computer so that you can back them up. And that is a little bit trickier just because it's hard to know which folders specifically on your device are your pictures. And it does depend on the version of Android or Google OS device that you do have. Usually it's going to be a folder, you know, within Documents, Photos, or what they have, DCIM. But it can be a little bit trickier. What I would just normally do, and I've done this with my phones in the past, I haven't looked around. I selected and copied everything and moved it over. And I should say copied over, not moved, because there are other system files potentially on your Google phone, but it allows you to at least make a backup where you're going to be able to find where those device or where those photos are. Because if they are on your phone, they should be readable as you plug it into your computer so that you can read those photos off and store them elsewhere. You can get a backup. You can get a backup application that's available in the Play Store that will allow you to back up your phone to a micro SD card. That is another good option. You can also actually back it up using different services like Dropbox to do that backup as well. But I would do the backup from photos.google.com and just try to do a backup there. In addition, I would back up your actual phone. Using it as like an external hard drive plugged into your computer. And if you really want to, you could also invest into a backup application for your Google device to actually back up to a micro SD card. There are some free options out there that will do this as well, but they can be a bit more complicated. If there is a well scored application that's out there for a small cost, that could also be a good option to back up your photos. But you do have some other third parties if you do want to use Dropbox or iCloud or something else. And then one thing I'd recommend when you are sharing photos, there's a lot of different defaults to Google phones or, you know, any phone or mobile device for that matter, many settings have for how they share the device. Sometimes they'll share a link to where the file is stored. So it might sort of Google Photos, or it might send it as an attachment for like an SMS or MMS message that you're sending to someone else. Generally, I like it when it's actually sending the attached photo rather than sending a link to the photo. And you might need to take a look into your settings for your phone to see how you can change that. But that's another option, at least to make sure that experience is going to be a little bit different. But you could also just, you know, move to a different service. Your photos can be backed up by Dropbox. I've used that in the past where if you take a picture on your phone, Dropbox can automatically back it up. And that's another great option. And there's many services like that to use.
All right. There you go, Jerry. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jesse LeGrew is our guest today. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look now at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Jesse LeGrew. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my technology expert, Jesse LeGrew. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. And great to have him back. And certainly he's ready to answer your technology questions. Lots of callers online. Let's and some emails, too. Let's go to Tim in Ladysmith next. Tim, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry and Jesse, thank you for taking my call. I've got about a 7-year-old Lenovo T520 laptop with obviously a Microsoft suite installed on it. I don't really install any open source on my computer. I really don't take a lot of stuff in, so I don't end up with keyloggers on my system. The problem I've been having is that, and maybe this is Microsoft's thing, I'm not sure, but every time Microsoft pushes an update to me, because I don't use Microsoft Edge for a browser, I use Google or Google Chrome. Every time it pushes it, and this last time it pushed it, it makes it so when I go into Google, open it up, and go to a page, it loads the page, but everything then crawls to a stop. I either have to try and reload the page, or sometimes I have to go in and clear my cache to get it working again. So I don't know if I can really, I guess a couple of things, because Edge is now launching all by itself, the Microsoft product. And then I don't know if when I go to accept a Microsoft update, if I can unpackage it and try and look and see if there's anything that's going to mess up my browser and take that off before I allow the update. So I could take my answer offline and if there's anything directly you want to ask.
What do you think, Jesse?
At least for most of the Microsoft updates, especially ones that I've received recently, usually it shouldn't be changing anything with Chrome or the behavior that you're seeing with that browser. I also wouldn't see a need to, you know, take a look at the updates and kind of what it's doing. Usually if there is kind of any issue, it's probably going to be affecting any Microsoft products that are installed within your operating system. And if there is going to be any browser change, it's going to be with Edge or, well, probably not Internet Explorer in this case, but Edge since it's the most recently supported browser. For Chrome, it does sound like you're having some interesting changes there. One thing I might recommend for Chrome, if there's a little bit of difference in behavior, is you know, make sure that auto update for Chrome is turned on and that it is at the latest updated version. I might also recommend taking a look at any plugins that you have installed for Chrome, just to see if there is anything that might be conflicting with you know the page that it's trying to load. You also might want to consider actually just setting Chrome to its default settings, which, you know, kind of wipes out anything you currently have customized. It might, you know, remove cookies, favorites, or, you know, saved browser tabs. But allowing your Chrome to start up fresh might be a benefit in case there is something in the background of the actual Chrome browser that might be causing an issue. And Windows shouldn't be necessarily changing the default for which browser you are using, but you can always check your program defaults and, you know, at least change it to a different browser such as Edge or Chrome and then change it back to Edge or Chrome just to make sure that your last setting change is taking effect and that you did explicitly choose Chrome as your most recent browser. So I'd recommend doing a few of those things just to take a look. If you do continue to notice other odd browser activity, whether it's your favorites are changing, your default browser is changing, I actually would recommend using an application like Malwarebytes or the built-in Windows Defender to scan your computer for anything that's unusual or malicious, because sometimes malicious applications can actually be changing those items rather than the patches, you know, that you might be getting from Microsoft or for Google Chrome. Usually that shouldn't be changing all the time, and that could be an indication that there's something else happening on your computer that otherwise you might not want to have on there. But at least it'll give you an indication of, you know, is there something there or not? But you might just want to, you know, uninstall and reinstall Chrome, reset the defaults and see how it changes. Definitely check just to see if there's anything else unusual on your computer. It does just take one website to click on that, you know, something unusual gets loaded on your computer for weird things to start happening. So definitely do a scan if you have a on-hand antivirus or anti-malware program just to verify there's nothing else weird on that computer.
All right. There you go, Tim. Thank you for calling. Larry in Janesville, your turn now. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Larry and Jesse. What would be the best cleaner and anti-malware for SE iPhone 2nd edition?
And that is, so for, and if I'm not mistaken, that is an older iPhone. Usually the built-in app store that is available through since everything you have to install, as long as you have not jailbroken or rooted your phone, you would normally have to install software directly through the App Store. And usually those applications are pretty well vetted to ensure that there's nothing going to be malicious on your device. So making sure that you don't jailbreak your phone and install anything outside of that application store is going to help ensure you don't have any kind of malware on your device. It is possible you might get something from a website, but you know usually it's going to be from other applications that you're installing. So the iPhone SE 2 is a 2020 device, so it is more recent. They do have built-in protections for the iPhone, including requiring the App Store. I would just recommend don't root or jailbreak your device. It may not cause any issues with support, but it could open you up to risk if you are installing third-party applications that may not be, you know, properly vetted, and they could actually just be malicious in nature because, you know, people want you to install it and it'll do bad things. outside of that, there are some, there is one application that I cannot recall. That can be used, and I think it's a paid product that can be used to verify whether there is anything unusual or malicious on your iPhone. I just cannot think of it, but I will continue to think of it, and I'll, if I can, I'll bring it up before the end of the program today. But generally, I would just make sure to use the App Store, look at the community there, and make sure you're installing applications that have generally a very good community support around. Usually the application protections you're going to have within the phone will be good for what you need. Just keep the device updated. So as there are updates for iOS, continue to keep those updates coming and keep them applied because those will help with any potentially malicious programs out there in the future.
There you go, Larry. Thank you so much for calling. Tim in Beaver Dam, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I have a VPN service that I use pretty religiously when I travel abroad. I'm just looking for an explanation on what that does as far as affording me protection.
Yeah, it's a good question. So they always, whenever anyone talks about VPN, they always talk about a tunnel, which is you're creating a tunnel of communication from one point to another point. And so you can kind of think of, think of a city and think about driving through the streets and going from point A to point B. You're going from one end of the city to the next. When you're moving through the city and driving down the roads, you know, people can see you, driving the path that you're traveling until you get to that second destination. What the tunnel does, which really what this is a virtual tunnel where your traffic is going. No one can see inside the tunnel, so they don't necessarily know what you're accessing, potentially even where you're accessing from or to, but it keeps all of that information protected so no one can see inside of that tunnel. So it protects your data from being viewable from others, including if you were in public Wi-Fi or in public locations. So, for example, if you're in a coffee shop and you are browsing the internet on their Wi-Fi, there are other individuals on that wireless network that might be able to see local traffic that's coming through the wireless network. But it's also a possibility that the coffee shop themselves, if they have a router or a compromised device, there could actually be information that the router's gathering that you might not be aware of. And that tunnel actually allows you to even protect that information so that router can also not get at that traffic. So it helps you really in a privacy to make sure no one can read inside of that information, including an internet service provider or other individuals on your local network that otherwise might be able to see that information. The information will be encrypted and it will really only show communication to you and that other end of the VPN tunnel. They won't be able to see what is the actual communication inside the tunnel. So it helps to keep that information protected and private. And at least that's kind of a rough overview of why it helps to protect your information, because really no one can see it. It's all encrypted, and they can't see the destination of where you're actually navigating to outside of the VPN, what they call a VPN concentrator itself. So it obscures all that other information, so no one knows basically what's going on underneath that tunnel.
And how do we get one?
There are a variety of ways to get one. There are a variety of free services, and there are a variety of paid services. Some of them actually come with a variety of security applications that you might have. If you do, for example, have a password manager, they may have free VPN services that come with it or discounts for VPN services that you can take advantage of. There also might be options for your internet service provider or even options through your employer, depending on, what services they have available. So there's a lot of great options out there. And you don't necessarily have to spend any money, but the more money you spend, generally you are going to get more options in terms of where you can connect to. So if you are an international traveler and need to access resources that are only available in the continental United States, you might need a VPN that can actually connect you back to the U.S. So there are some options there, but there's also options the other direction. So I know ExpressVPN, NordVPN, ProtonVPN, there are a lot of them out there. The one thing I'd recommend is if you are looking for a VPN service, get one that is, once again, popular and well-documented and that has been doing the work for quite a period of time. While VPN can help to keep your information private, it's also something where the other end of that VPN tunnel, they have potentially the capability to get all of your information because they're helping to secure it and encrypt it from your end to their end. So make sure that it's a service that you are confident in their security because trust in that provider is extremely important because they could potentially have a lot of access to your data really because they're helping to secure it. So don't get something that just showed up yesterday or might be completely free because sometimes free services find ways to pay the bills in other ways. And that could include sharing your data or maybe not adhering to some security best practices. So paying for something usually gives you a little bit more protection. That's not always the case. But in many cases, you will pay a premium to get a better level of service, including higher bandwidth or more capabilities.
All right. you kind of get what you pay for there, I think, a little bit. Mike, yeah. Thanks again, Tim, by the way. Mike in Coon Valley, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jesse. I got an iPhone, and I did something to it where now when I'm on email, when I'm typing in a message, it just keeps going all the way across the screen, and I can't see everything I've written already. And then when I attach pictures, they're huge. So how do I get it back to how it was? When I do messages, it's perfect. It saves all within the screen and stuff, but email has just gone crazy on me.
Hmm. Have you turned it off and turned it back on again?
Yes, I tried that this morning.
Okay.
And so when you're trying to use email, are you using a web browser or an email client to write emails?
It'd be Yahoo.
Okay. And when it's actually moving across the screen, do you notice like if there was somebody typing on the keyboard, or it's just generally moving?
It's just sort of moves when I type on the keyboard. It just advances and just continues across instead of staying within the screen.
Okay. What it could be, there might be an option, and I haven't used the Yahoo interface recently. They usually have an option called Word Wrap. Which may or may not be turned on. I don't think I've seen it in a browser or a different program, but that might be what it is. And so what WordWrap does is as soon as you hit the end of the line, it kind of creates a virtual return where then it goes to the second line and you can keep on typing. With WordWrap turned off, it's kind of one long continuous line that never ends unless you hit enter or you hit something else. And it could be that the actual word wrap is turned off. I haven't seen that before on a browser-based email, but it is a possibility that they do have a feature where they are showing that display a little bit differently. Where I would look for that in the Yahoo email, usually it's probably going to be in settings where you can change your font, your size, your bold or italicized. So a lot of the font formatting features might have an option to turn on or to turn off word wrap, which is usually two words. So I would take a look to see if word wrap is an option that you can actually turn back on. I have a feeling that's probably going to be what you're looking for.
Good luck, Mike. Thank you so much for calling. A listener emailed to ask if you could talk about Cash App. They're wondering if it's legitimate or if it could be associated with scam somehow.
And I have not used the Cash App myself. I did take a quick look. It is available on the Google Play Store in addition to the Apple Store. Just knowing that the Apple Store and the Google Store do have a variety of checks and balances in terms of applications that can be made available, there's a higher likelihood it's probably a valid application and that it's not malicious. But I do actually see there are a variety of individuals that are using the application, and it tends to be it's definitely newer. It's free. And a lot of people seem to use it. It seems to get good reviews. I wouldn't necessarily be concerned with usage of the app. But I would still read at least a few reviews and the summary of the application itself. It does look like it can be used to send and receive money, assuming this is the application that I'm looking at. Sometimes there's a lot of applications with the same name. So it does seem to be a valid application that you can use. There are a lot of applications like this that are out there. I've used a few. Sometimes your bank will have a different application itself. definitely with these, I would definitely read the reviews and read a lot more on the apps themselves prior to using it, just because these have been increasingly popular, and there's kind of an enhanced risk of getting something where you are putting potentially bank account information or other details into these applications so you can transfer money back and forth, which does put those accounts at risk. So I always tend to go towards anything that might be built in with a banking application, or even other services that have been around for a while, such as PayPal. But there are new applications that are, you know, completely secure and valid. And I should say completely with an asterisk, nothing's completely secure, but you can at least be a little bit more confident that you're not going to lose your money on it. So it does seem to be valid. I haven't used it myself, but definitely read the fine print. And if you can, you know, take a look at valid services that you might already have available. This is free. There do seem to be some potential fees or earnings that you can make. So it almost looks like a banking app, like a bank itself. But that I haven't read too much up on it. I'd probably need to read more. But there's a Clear Cash app that's actually for clearing your cash, and it's for privacy. But there's a cash app that can actually use for sending and spending money. So hopefully we got the right app. Always be careful. If it is for transferring funds, use funds that or applications that might be available from your bank. And a lot of the Clear Cash apps, if it's to clear temporary files, your devices usually have options built in for that as well, where you can just clear up unnecessary files or cookies or any other information that you don't have. So, I got. So hopefully you hit one of them.
David from Whitehall, maybe you can answer this in a minute or so. They're called two browsers, Opera and Local. Do you know anything about those two?
Opera I've used before. So Opera is a web browser that's been available for quite some time. I haven't used it in a while. It is based on Chromium. But it is not Chrome, but it does have a variety of features that are similar. So it does try to tout itself as a privacy browser. There are a lot out there as well, like DuckDuckGo. If you actually want a different browser, there's tons of them out there. But Opera is a valid browser. I haven't seen it in use as much recently, but it is an option out there. The Local browser isn't one that I'm as familiar with, but it does seem to give you options from different locations. But Opera has been valid, and it's easy to use, but it's one of many.
Jesse, thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow we'll talk with a Wisconsin doctor and vascular neurologist about strokes, and then talk about managing the psychological side of going through cancer. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.